1994, you're a lawyer working in LA. You hear a guest speaker talk about Rwanda and what's going on there. What really got you interested enough to pursue trying to become a part of this team to investigate these crimes?
Yeah, well, you know, in 94, I really had no idea that a genocide actually took place in Rwanda. And when I was sitting in this room, it was basically a staff meeting and this lawyer was speaking to us, my first thought was of shock and then surprise. Shock because I had no idea that 1 million people were killed in 100 days. I had heard about the humanitarian crisis coming out of Rwanda and into Zaire of 2 million people or refugees moving across the border. But I had no idea that there was that type of death and atrocities. Secondly, I was surprised because the person speaking was a lawyer. And I was like, wow, you know, this is a job. You know, lawyers can actually go and do a fact-finding mission for the United Nations and write a report for the Security Council. So that is what intrigued me. And we have to keep in mind at that time, it hadn't been done. It hadn't been done before. So this was new. This was novel. And it really captured my attention.
Now, movies like Hotel Rwanda have brought the story of the 1994 genocide to American audiences. But I think what's less known or talked about is the systemic rape of Tutsi women. What was the extent of this? Because obviously a million people died, but how many were affected by the sexual crimes going on?
Yeah, that's a real tough figure to capture. If someone were to ask me, I would say tens of thousands, and I've heard the numbers be in the hundreds of thousands, and they're all credible. If you speak to a particular survivor, she will tell you that everyone she knows that is alive was a victim of sexual violence. So with a population at the time was of 8 million people, you can imagine how many victims or potential victims there were, which also brings back the point of being shocked that you have this extensive abuse and we don't hear about it. And even today, it's barely talked about, unfortunately.
Especially with sexual assault and rape, how it's a very underreported phenomenon. Do you think there's probably many more we don't know about?
Oh, for sure. I think there's definitely many more that we don't know about Rwanda, in Rwanda, because you have to keep in mind, particularly back then, it was a taboo subject in Africa and really throughout the world. Because if you're a rape victim survivor, it's tough to put yourself out there and have it be known and effectively put a letter on, you know, on your back so everyone knows that you were a victim of multiple acts of sexual violence. So I'm sure there are a lot of victims that did not feel comfortable coming forward. And I think that continues today, whether it's domestic or in other conflicts around the world. And just take a look at what's happening in northern Iraq and Syria. Take a look at what's happening in the Congo. We know, and take a look at what's happening in Nigeria with the Boko Haram. We know that there are victims of sexual violence, but I think a lot of them are still trying to come to terms with what happened to them and find the courage and the ability to come out and speak forward.
Right? So the first conviction for rape as a war crime, which your team was investigating, and was handed to a mayor. Who was this first person brought to justice, and what were some of his crimes that you were charged with investigating?
Yeah, so his name is he's still alive, Jean-Paul Akayesu, and he was the mayor of a town. And interestingly enough, in Rwanda, the mayor is an extremely powerful position. And I think you'll see that a lot in the developing world, where at that level, it is an authority who is closest to the people. And the people in the community look to that authority for guidance. They'll go to that authority hat in hand with great deference, asking for assistance, whether it's with education, neighborly dispute, healthcare, family dispute. So in certain ways, the mayor is more powerful than the head of state, because he, at that time they were all he's, had the full command and respect of the population. So when we investigated him and brought him to trial, we were charging him with genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And within crimes against humanity and war crimes, there are various acts, including killing, torture, rape, inhumane acts, and the list literally goes on. This case was the first time that genocide had ever been prosecuted. It was passed in 1948 and after World War II and remained dormant for 50 years until we picked it up and dusted the document off. And it also was the first time that we were prosecuting rape committed and sexual violence committed in times of conflict. So we did two things. We charged him as part of genocide. We considered rape as an act of genocide. And we also charged it with crimes against humanity and war crimes.
Rape as a weapon, the idea that rape is used as a part of this genocide, and I think it's been fairly common, unfortunately, in warfare throughout human history has been the use of rape as a weapon. From what you were able to gather when you've worked on cases like this, what kind of devastation does this do to a community such as the Tutsis that were targeted with rape?
Well, that's a very, very important question because the answer puts into context what rape really is. Rape not only is an act of torture and extreme violence, but it's also an act designed to destroy. Not only does it destroy the victim herself or himself, for that matter, but it also destroys the fabric of the community. You know, you have to think about the fact that when you have mothers, sisters, or whomever that are being violated in the most horrific way, they're being violated in public, and it's known, the impact that it has on the others in the community, whether they're male or female, is dramatic. And what it does to that social group or ethnic group, it continues to not only belittle, but also, as I said, destroy. So when you have a situation, for example, in Rwanda, where you have a particular ethnic group that's being targeted for killing, inhumane acts, and sexual violence, you can see how the combination of all that really destroys the group in whole or in part. Now, the victims may still be in existence, such as a survivor of sexual violence, but she's not herself. She can no longer contribute to society in an effective and meaningful way. She may be off in the corner, and we lose the benefit of the human exchange, the diversity that normally occurs when you have someone that is able to reach out and participate. But now with all this violence and as a victim, they're effectively, as one victim has said to me, the walking dead.
Something we hinted at earlier was the difficulty also in reporting these crimes. I can imagine that when you were working in Rwanda in this particular case, that there was definitely an uphill climb to get evidence of this. Because I know from what I read originally, this wasn't on the list of charges against this particular mayor.
Yeah, that's right. We ultimately amended the indictment to include it. We were aware that there was systematic rape, and we were looking for the evidence that could link it to our accused, but we just didn't have it in the very beginning. And part of that was because of the reporting issue, and it's fully understandable. You know, if you put yourself in the shoes of these women who have been through these horrific events, then you have outsiders, foreigners coming in and saying, "Hey, we're here to investigate. We're from the United Nations that actually let you down during the genocide and did not stop the genocide, and now you're saying we're here to help." You know, it doesn't really exude confidence because, you know, if you're one of these victims, why would you speak out if you feel that nothing will be done about it? Why would you expose yourself to the perceived shame or humiliation or whatever the sentiment they may be feeling for nothing? So it took us a while to build that confidence, to let them know that if you show the courage, if you step forward, if you speak, we will use that and make something happen with that.
I've got to imagine also that in these circumstances that there was also probably intimidation of witnesses.
Yeah, there was plenty of intimidation. I mean, if you think about it, you're dealing with a situation where a million people were killed. There's no reason why they wouldn't kill a witness. So we did see that. We saw, you know, witnesses being afraid. We had actually witnesses being killed. Before the start of our trial, we had several witnesses being killed. And it was an effort for us to persuade people to come forward and expose themselves and put themselves at further risk for the sake of justice.
With rape being classified as a war crime decades before this trial, why do you think that is?
You know, that's a difficult question to answer. And really, I don't have the answer. It's just I'm a little dumbfounded by the fact that it had not been prosecuted. It was on the books since 1919, and no one did anything about it. Everyone knew rape was occurring. We knew it was occurring in World War II, Japan, during World War II and afterward, and people just didn't do anything about it. They considered it just, these things happen in war, and what we will be prosecuting when we're prosecuting war crimes or crimes against humanity is the killing and the destruction of historical sites or whatever it may be. So it's really difficult to answer. And even if you go back to and you look at the decisions coming out of Nuremberg or the Far East at the time, they talked about the sexual violence. I mean, it's written right in there what at the time the Japanese were doing and others. But it's for some reason people just did not think that it was sufficient enough to prosecute on its own merits. And our job in with the tribunal was really to put this crime on equal footing once and for all.
After this trial, you went on to continue working on war crimes cases with two different White House administrations. What are you up to today?
Yeah, well, today I'm in private practice. I left government when I was ambassador at large, and as you said, I would deal with these issues worldwide, whether it was throughout Africa, all those conflicts, the Balkans, Bosnia, former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Sierra Leone, you just name your place. But now in private practice, my work is a little more of a mixed portfolio. Obviously, there's commercial aspects, but I do try to remain involved in issues relating to human rights and help where I can. Every once in a while, I'll get a call from either individuals or sometimes countries to help out on these complex issues. And I feel that with my background and knowledge, it's a duty anyway to at least provide some insight.
It also seems like sexual assault and rape as a topic is coming up more now, especially in the news, not necessarily as a war crime, but just the crime in general. So there's this sense that society is at least trying to discuss this topic more than it has in the past. Are you hopeful that it's getting to that point where rape laws will be enforced internationally?
Well, I hope. I hope. I think the dialogue is there. I think we're seeing victims more willing to come forward, and they're recognizing that they are victims and not responsible. But I think we still have a long way to go. For some reason, people still believe that they can commit these acts, that they can devalue another person. But where I do believe there is some slippage and we're not doing enough is on the international stage, particularly in conflicts. And I talked earlier about the Nigeria and Boko Haram, where they effectively abducted, dozens of girls. And we're not, I'm not talking women, I'm talking girls, and have been holding them as slaves and sex slaves. We talk about in northern Iraq, ISIS, when what they're doing to the Yazidi population. You have a lot of girls. And I met a 14-year-old a few weeks ago who was captured by them, abused in the most horrific manner as a sex slave, and she and other 14-year-old girls. And the only reason she was able to tell me the story is because one night she and a couple of the girls tied some bed sheets together, climbed out of the window of where they were being held, and fled and made their way out of captivity, ultimately to Europe and then to the U.S. So it's, the international community has a lot of work to do. We seem to condemn these actions. We seem to say, you can't do it, never again. But I don't see any follow-up. You can't call it a genocide, as Secretary Kerry did, and the UN did this year, speaking with the Yazidi population, and then not do anything about it. Words are not enough.
The work that you and your team did in the mid-90s is now the subject of the documentary The Uncondemned. You were approached about this film. What were your feelings about being made part of the subject of this film?
Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, the story had been there for, you know, now, 20 years or so. And I never really went out to have the story highlighted in film or books because I never felt comfortable. When the director, Michelle Mitchell, approached me, it'll be 4 years ago in January, I really got a good feeling from her. I felt that she understood the significance, the importance, and would treat the story with dignity. So I decided that I was willing to get involved, help her in shaping the story by giving her all the materials I had, my memory, as well as directing her to other participants in the process. And now that the film is out, it was released on October 21st, I think they did a masterful job, and it's really a story that obviously we talk about a difficult period in history, but in the end you can see that with hard work, determination, and commitment, humanity can prevail.
All right. Well, Ambassador Prosper, thank you so much.
Well, great. Evan, thank you for having me.